Because as the old saying goes, there's an app for everything.
All righty. We get to discuss conquest today. So, we left off talking about
the Ottoman Sultan Bazayed I, talked about some of the innovations that he brought forward to engage in his efforts to adhere to Uthman's dream to conquer and spread Islam. And as I was doing, going through some of the major innovations that occurred during the reigns of the series of sultans that slowly and incrementally would give structure to what would become the Ottoman system. These last components were huge. Fatwas, these legal declarations that came from Islamic scholars used to justify what we would consider to be holy war. Because if you are going to, and again, the Quran basically says Muslims are not supposed to fight Muslims. You know, once you become a Muslim, you submit to Allah, you are all equal in Allah's eyes. But how can you fight wars against other Muslims when you're focused on conquest? Well, you make up justification. And the justification was they didn't practice the right form of Islam. He also built one of the first standing armies in modern history. Soldiers, that's all they were paid to do. They spent their days drilling and preparing to fight. Always ready to go to war and kill in the Sultan's name. And he also was the first ruler to adopt and embrace artillery. You're David, right?
Yeah.
He would adopt the use of bombards, siege equipment, which basically brought an end to the style of warfare that had been in place for all of human civilization, in which you attack a city by laying siege to it. You encircle it. You starve it out. Who are you? It's been a while. Just FYI, you've completely exceeded the allowed absences, so your averages are going to start taking a hit, so don't miss any more classes. All right, bombards, siege engines, guns. You put gunpowder down in the bottom, and you fire trajectories the size of, well, yay big, firing through the air at subsonic speed, smashes into the walls and pulverizes them. Because once you can get through the walls, you take the city. All of these innovations, unique, but incrementally, they would make the Ottoman forces some of the most lethal fighters on earth. With this, he did something that, well, all modern military analysts would say was stupid. He actually intentionally launched a two-front war. From the Ottoman Empire in the core, they attacked north, and they attacked east, dividing their forces, going in multiple directions. But like I said last class, he used Christians to attack the Muslims and Muslims to attack the Christians. His primary objective was Byzantium in its ancient capital city of Constantinople. Constantinople had been the capital for what we would technically call the Eastern Roman Empire since it was first selected by the Roman Emperor Diocletian. Way back in around 300 AD. It was then expanded by the Roman Emperor Constantine. And that's where it gets its name.
Constantinople.
Constantine City. And since that period, so we're talking 300-ish AD, all the way up until 1400, 1100 years of expansion and strength. Although by this point it was on decline because it had lost most of its empire. But the walls were still some of the most formidable walls ever built. This is an artist rendering of what the Ottomans would need to get through to get to the city. And coincidentally, this structure managed to prevent 27 attempts throughout history to actually take the city. Side note, the only people to actually get through and into the city were the Crusaders during the Fourth Crusade. But as far as the Muslims go, no success. Because again, look, you had this massive moat. So if you're coming across the battlefield and you're going to attack the city, you have to have your soldiers first jump into a moat. We all know what a moat is, right? And then somehow they have to get through the obstacles that are entrenched in the moat and then climb out. But we got a little tiny wall, which makes it taller than a human height to get out of the water. And even then, you still have to run across another area before you have to deal with the outer wall. And by the way, stationed in all of the walls and on top of the walls are soldiers shooting down at you. But then, even if you can even get through the outer walls, then you have to deal with the inner wall. 40 feet thick at its base, 60 feet tall. Completely encircling the city. Now, Bazayed would try. He would lay siege to Constantinople for 7 years. And during this time, he held off attacks because some of the Europeans marched armies down, the King of Poland, to help out the Byzantines. But he managed to drive them back. By the way, Constantinople was able to hold out because of its design. And there is going to be a picture coming up. In between the Theodosian Wall, which that is, there was a vast plain before you hit an inner wall. And all on that inner wall were farms. So unlike any other city that needs to import food, Constantinople had the ability to produce its own food. Plus, you could get to it by sea. So they were constantly getting more supplies if they needed. But Bazayed did not have the technology. He had some bombards, but he could not get them close enough to the city to be effective against the system. Why? The guns were heavy. They were big. And he did not have the ability to obtain or quarry ammunition. So FYI, if you're going to go to fight and you have a gun, make sure you have bullets with you before you attack. It's kind of safe. Well, despite his efforts to take the city, he was soon distracted when his empire was invaded by Timur. Timur was a conqueror who claimed to be a descendant of Genghis Khan. He had been causing havoc all through modern Iran and Iraq. And in 1400, he swept into Turkey, modern Turkey. Well, when Bazayed, who had been at Constantinople,
learn that his empire had been invaded, he abandons the siege, travels across the Dardanelles, and races across Turkey to intercept Timur, where unfortunately his forces were defeated at the Battle of Ankara and he'd be captured. And he would remain in captivity until he died in 1405. At this point, one of the greatest weaknesses of the Ottoman Empire was exposed. They had no succession scheme. In Europe, king dies, it passes to his son. If there is no son, you find the closest living male relative. But in Islamic tradition, all of the sons have claim. And what's the big deal? Well, these sultans had harems. And they get to sleep with lots and lots of women. Which means there were lots and lots of sons. And each son had equal right to claim the possessions of the father. So what ended up happening, when Timur was captured, his four oldest sons actually instigated a civil war. And they began fighting against one another to take the throne. This went on for 10 years. The Ottoman Empire was almost completely ripped apart. And it's either just by sheer luck that the winner of the civil war, his fourth son, Mehmet I, managed to be successful. But even then, he didn't stabilize the empire. Provinces began to break away. And nor could Mehmed's oldest son, Murad, couldn't stabilize the empire either. And by 1450, it looked as if the Ottoman Empire was just going to become one of those other failed empires that we read about in history, kind of like a comet. They streak through the sky, they're bright when they burn, and then they fade away. Well, fortunately for the Ottomans, Murad II's son, Mehmed, had the vision and the ability to bring the empire back together and pursue Usman's quest. All right, Netflix. I think they call it The Ottoman. They have a docudrama. So it's kind of like a documentary, but it's actually, there's some drama in it. There's acting, tells a story in it as well. The first season covers what I'm going to talk about now. In 1451, he takes control. He becomes the Sultan. And upon achieving the Sultanate, his primary goal was to get rid of Constantinople. He wanted to conquer it. Now, interestingly enough, Mehmed had read history. And he dreamed of reestablishing the might and glory of Rome. So his first objective was to conquer the capital of the Eastern Empire. And then once he conquered Constantinople, he then would attempt to conquer Rome. Because he wanted to make the Mediterranean an Ottoman lake, just like it had once been a Roman lake. Oh, by the way, as I said, here's the outer wall, and here's that inner wall that I was talking about. But if you'll notice,
geographically, it's on a peninsula.
That's called the Golden Horn.
So to attack it by the land, you basically have to go at the wall. Or you could attack it by sea. But over the centuries, they had built up a wall system and defenses all along the coast. Including, for those of you in the back probably can't see it, but you guys in front can see it, they also had built concrete inlets so a ship could safely come into this artificial harbor. But the enemies could be repelled. And lastly, at some point they built a massive fortress on the other side of the entranceway, but this entranceway could be closed by a massive iron chain that they could lower or raise, allowing friendly ships to come in and holding enemy ships at bay.
Now, strong, powerful defenses. But by 1451, the city, which once had a population of somewhere between 700,000 and 800,000 people, had shrunk down to about 50,000. So you take that 50,000 and you cut it in half, men and women, so that brings you to about 25,000. And then you cut that maybe into a third, because the little boys can't fight, neither can the old men. So you're talking at most, what, 10,000 soldiers? If that many, to defend all of these defenses? My men knew how weak the city was. So, unlike his great-grandfather, he would build up his strength because he aimed to attack and conquer the city, not just lay siege to it. And he did many things. He ordered the construction of a navy. The Ottomans never had ships before. So with these ships, they weren't strong enough to attack the water defenses, but they could block access from anyone trying to help out the Ottomans by sea. He also built up massive fortifications all the way down the coastline, because there is a water channel here that gets you into the Black Sea. So, with these fortresses that they were down there, they could open fire on any ships trying to get in or out. They also started landing troops on this side of the river. Built an army, 150,000. He deploys them. 100,000 see outside the plain in front of the walls. That 100,000 is twice as much as the entire population of the city, men and women combined. And then he goes to work. He closes off the land routes. He also begins cutting the forest well out of sight of the Byzantines, because what he would build is basically a highway in which he could take ships, pull them across by land, and drop them into the river upstream, because all of the Ottoman defenses are down towards the southern tip. All up here, weak, not really protected. Soldiers here, ships down here, surrounding them on all sides. But
He also needed a little extra oh, side note. Remember when we talked about the Ottomans triggering the Age of Exploration? This is why. Oh, to be one of the richest men on earth. A Hungarian metal, or a person owned an ironworks, a metal factory, had been making small bombards. But on a whim, he decided to create the super weapon of the day, commonly referred to as the Orban bombards. By the way, his name is Orban. These massive guns, 27 feet long, capable of projecting a 700-pound stone at subsonic speed a mile in the distance. Ironically, Orban had actually gone and met with the Emperor of Constantinople first. The emperor at the time was Constantine XI, and he offered to sell him these guns. But the emperor didn't have any money. Constantinople was bankrupt. So he had to say no. So of course, all weapons manufacturers, they're only loyal to the green stuff. So when he was rejected in Constantinople, he went and met with Mehmed, who bought 70 of them. For 57 days, the Ottomans unleashed hell.
Boom, 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 all over the length of the wall. The biggest problem was not that the walls could resist the volleys, but when the stone smashed into the wall, all it did was cause the wall to collapse. So by pounding it, all they were doing was making a big pile of rubble, which isn't the easiest thing to get through. And even if a breach was made, the Byzantine soldiers did their best to basically plug the gap.
But on the 57th day,
they blasted a big enough hole in because the Ottoman ships began attacking along the far coast. Constantine the 11th was forced to divide his forces, pulling men from the outer wall to defend the inner structures. And in the end, they just didn't have enough troops to cover everything.
The Ottomans would gain the breach. And as payment for their service, Mehmed allowed them to do whatever they wanted for 3 days. Looting, pillaging, raping. The few ancient artifacts that were left in the city, going back all the way time to ancient Roman times, gone. Anything that was gold or silver, gone. Precious gemstones were carved out of walls and statues. They looted graves. Raped women. Killed anyone who stood in their way. Including the last technical Roman emperor. He was last seen leading a detachment of soldiers into the big breach that the Ottomans would charge. But nobody knew what happened to him. He died and they never found the body. Ironically, though, Constantine's sons would be captured. And in the tradition of the Janissaries, they would be converted to Islam. The former emperor's oldest son would become governor general of the Balkans. And the youngest son would become the admiral of the Ottoman fleet. But Rome was dead. And Mehmed earned his name, the Conqueror. Once the looting was ended, he would raise the crescent moon, the symbol of the Ottomans, on the highest edifices. And he would proclaim this city to be the new Ottoman capital. Questions? Well, once in possession of Constantinople, they continued to conquer. For the next 30 years, the remainder of his life, Ottoman forces not only pushed the border further into Anatolia, but Ottoman troops entered and subjugated the Crimea. And they pushed into the Balkans, conquering Serbia and Bulgaria and Greece. At one point, they also prepared an invasion to go into Italy. But one weird thing happened that caused Mehmed to take his eyes off the prize. And that weird thing, if you have Netflix and you watch The Ottoman Season 2, is covered there. This. Wallachia. Was the distraction. Now, FYI, the dark green are the areas that he conquered and he controlled. The light green are vassals. So at some point, a ruler bent the knee and submitted, but they were allowed to remain in charge. And that was the case in Wallachia. That was until Vlad the Third, known as Dracula, would assume the throne. Vlad was the oldest son of Vlad the Second. Dracul, Vlad the Second was known as. Dracul means dragon. Vlad II was a member of a secret society known as the Order of the Dragon. And the Order of the Dragon were kind of like crusaders. They were knights who pledged to protect Christianity. Dracula is Wallachian for son of the dragon. Now, for Vlad II to keep the throne, he had to pay the devshrim. He had to pay the blood tax. So, in making a deal with Mehmed's father, Murad II, Vlad II allowed his older son, Vlad III, and his younger son, Radu, to basically become political prisoners, hostages. They were brought to the capital of the Ottoman Empire, and for about a decade, they remained there. Now, the catch is, Radu would convert to Islam, and he would become one of Mehmed's most loyal generals. But Vlad, who was 16, was old enough to play the game. He secretly remained a Christian and only pretended to convert. because he knew at some point his dad would die and he'd be able to go back and be put on the throne. So that's why he played the game. But when he was there, he learned the Turkish language. He learned the customs of the Ottomans, including their fighting techniques. Well, long story short, Vlad II dies. Murat allows Vlad III to leave, and shortly thereafter he died and Mehmed takes the throne. Vlad initially pledges his fealty to the conqueror. But in 1459, he changed his mind. I think I have that as a click. No, I don't. An ambassador from Mehmed shows up and demands tribute. He wants 10,000 ducats. Ducat was a coin, weighed about 3.5 ounces, minted out of solid gold. So I don't know what the price per ounce in gold is, but these coins are pretty valuable by today's standards. Oh, he also demanded 500 soldiers. So, soldiers, money. Well, Vlad decided not to comply. He said to the envoys, take off your turbans when you enter a building dedicated to Christ. It is custom that you remove your hats. It's disrespectful to Jesus to wear your hats in his presence. Sultan said, well, A, we're not Christians, we're Muslims, and B, in Islam, the only people we take our turbans off to is for Allah. Insulted, Vlad ordered the turbans to be nailed to their skulls. Obviously, if you get a nail that gets spiked into your skull, you die. Well, he had the bodies put on horses, sent back to Mehmed. Mehmed was furious. He figured his old friend was delusional. So he sent a small detachment of soldiers to kind of smack him around a little bit. Or, if necessary, just kill him. But Vlad knew they were coming. And because Vlad knew his land, he knew which routes they would take. So what does he do? He takes his most elite soldiers and he hides out into the woods. And he waits. He sets an ambush. He captured a scout, took his clothes, disguised himself as an Ottoman soldier, walked all the way up to the camp. But because he knew Turkish, he started talking to the guard. And the guard basically let him by. At which time, Vlad turned around and killed him. And gave the signal and had all his men pour into the camp. Captured all of the Ottoman soldiers. And then impaled them. 10-12 foot long wooden timber spike shoved up the ass all the way through your body and usually popping out the side of your neck. And he planted it into the ground. He then had his men take all of the uniforms and all of the weapons, and now suddenly he had an army of Muslim fighters, Ottoman fighters. And they began roving the countryside. Mehmed gets furious.
he sends more and more men, and each time
they're captured and impaled.
By the way, it's estimated that by the time this series of events ended, there were over 20,000 Ottoman soldiers hanging on spikes throughout the land.
Mehmed was inflamed.
His planned attempt to invade Italy was put on hold, and he re-diverted all of his strength.
Well, long story short, eventually, Mehmed was able to penetrate Wallachia, and Vlad was forced to retreat up into the mountains. Mehmed would then put Radu on the throne, but Vlad would remain engaged in guerrilla war for the next 10 years. Eventually, Radu died, and the Wallachian nobles would allow Vlad to be restored to the throne, but he only lived for a year before he died of natural causes. But because of Dracula, the Christian world was saved.
While the Ottoman attempts to invade Italy subsided, they did, for the next 100 years, continue to expand. They would roll over Wallachia, they would seize Transylvania, Moldavia, they would seize Hungary, Bosnia, Croatia. They would even get all the way to the gates of Vienna in Austria. At the same time, they spread out of Turkey into Armenia and down into the Middle East. They conquered all of the holy sites. They went all the way down through all of the villages and cities that dot the Arabian coast. By the way, they had no use to going here where it says Arabia, because you know what's there? Desert, yeah, there's no point in wasted men trying to conquer sand. They would conquer Egypt. They would spread across North Africa, getting almost to the Straits of Gibraltar.
Conquest to conquest to conquest. They also maintained a navy.
And that allowed them to get Crete in many of the Mediterranean islands.
It seemed as if nothing could stop them. And they attempted to unite all Muslims by establishing themselves as the protectors all of Islam's holy sites. But of course, the Europeans referred to them as the scourge of Christendom. Why didn't they win? Well, they literally would run out of steam. In 1683,
220 years after the fall of Constantinople, one of the last great Ottoman empires was laying siege to the city of Vienna.
Now, FYI, technology had changed by this point. Gone were the bows and arrows, gone were the swords and the spears, and gone were the big bombards. Instead, the soldiers had mostly matchlock muskets.
There was still artillery, but the gun shrunk. There were more field pieces.
So think of the cannons that fire, sometimes they're called 10 pounders, fire shot about the size of a candle pin. Not really good against big walls, but really good against human beings. Well, the Ottoman army had 140,000 men and had 150 cannon with them. And inside the city was a garrison of only 16,000 soldiers. But they had 140 cannon. So pound for pound, they were about the same. So imagine for me this. You have your city surrounded in a wall. You got the enemy's army out here. They have guns. You have guns. Because their guns were in a higher position, they could shoot just a little farther. Which meant if you move your guns up close, they could blow it up. So if you can't use guns, what do you use? Will any of you ever hear of sapping? A sapper, essentially, is a miner. And so what they began doing was digging underground tunnels. And they would attempt to dig a tunnel underneath the wall. And you would put something flammable. Sometimes gunpowder. Sometimes pigs. Pigs. Pig fat burns really hot. Because I'm sure you all took physics, right? What happens to anything when it heats up? And then what happens when the fire goes out? And it starts getting cold? It shrinks. So imagine the earth expanding and then suddenly receding. That destabilizes under the ground and causes the walls to fall. Out of pure luck, when the siege began, there was, I can't remember the life of me, his name. There was a guy from Scotland there who himself happened to be a master sapper. So he collaborated with the Austrians, and every single day he would go out just beyond the wall, and they didn't have stethoscopes, they didn't have ground penetrating radar, but somehow he knew how to listen and he could hear the digging. He would then order a crew of men to come out with them, and they would drive massive stakes into the ground, frequently impaling the Ottoman sappers. So, despite their best efforts, they couldn't get in. Out of sheer luck also, the Austrians managed to get word out, begging for help. And as it turns out, on September 6th, 80,000 Christian soldiers arrive, including the famed Polish hussars, some of the elite heavy knights, and they wore big wings that made them look like, you know, really badass dudes. This forced the Ottomans' hands. They can't get through the walls, but they know the enemy is coming up behind them. So, on 4 a.m. on September 11th, the Ottomans decided to risk it all and attack the city. But the problem was, is because they didn't breach the defenses, they were caught between an iron hammer and an anvil. By 9 a.m., the Ottoman forces were shattered. They lost of their 140,000 men. I think they suffered like 100,000 casualties. They lost all their big equipment, their guns, and the few were forced to flee. Christianity beat Islam. And by the way, side note, that's the reason why Osama bin Laden chose September 11th to attack the World Trade Centers. Because unlike us today, who have no concept of history, the Muslims, they don't forget. So September 11th, 2001 was payback for September 11th, 1683. But even though they weren't able to get into Europe, they still remained a thorn in the European side all the way up until the 19th century.
Questions?
All right. What contributed to this sudden downfall? Well, truth be told, as fierce and violent as they were, they had a lot of internal problems that would ultimately, slowly over time, erode their strength. Now, on paper, the Ottoman sultans were like absolute monarchs. Their word literally was law. But to control the empire, going all the way back to Osman himself, the sultans were forced to pay for their soldiers. And they did so with war. I'm sure you've all heard the expression, the spoils of war. Well, whenever things were looking a little precarious politically at home, a sultan would issue a fatwa and the soldiers would go to war. They'd rape, loot, and pillage, and there was their pay. But the problem is if you have an economy geared toward war and expansion, you need to continually win. You need to conquer more lands because you need to obtain more resources. But the problem is when you start to lose. Then what? Complicating things was the sultans had to play politics. Because there was several very powerful groups in the empire, any one of which had the ability to launch a coup, challenge the sultan, overthrow the sultanate. At its core, he had to deal with the Ottoman nobility. The nobles are known as Sipahi. The Ottoman nobles are no different than the European nobles. They were born into their special families, and their special families gave them privileges and extra rights, including the right to own land. The Sipahi controlled the peasants, just like in Europe. But the Sipahi also served as the warrior class. So at their beginning, they were the cavalry. Well, over time, these Sipahi at times forced the sultans to go to war so they could get more land. Because if they could get more land, they could get more money. In some ways, they're also similar to the Bushi warriors of the military clans. Very difficult to deal with. Eventually, even the Sultan's most trusted soldiers, the Janissaries, would also become a threat. Why? Well, by the 19th century, the 1800s, there were over 300,000 Janissaries. These were men that were taken from Christian homes, converted to Islam, and these were to serve as the loyal sword of the Sultan. Any of you ever learn about Roman history at all, particularly the imperial history? When the emperors had to deal with the Praetorian guards? If you have professional soldiers, you have to pay the soldiers. But if you don't have the money, you can't pay the soldiers. And what do soldiers that don't get paid have a tendency to do? Yeah, they overthrow the emperors. I can think of at least 4 Roman emperors that when the army didn't pay them, they killed the emperor and put somebody on the throne. Now the Janissaries, they would become a threat. You had to deal with the nobility, you had to deal with your soldiers. Oh, you also had to deal with the priests. The ulemas. The ulemas are the Islamic scholars. They're the theologians. They're the ones who are allowed to read Islamic law and make decrees. By the way, if you've ever heard of Sharia law, Sharia law is like the ecclesiastical law for Islamic societies. In Islam, there is no separation of church and state. The laws of the religion are the laws of the state. Well, because they are entrusted with interpreting the Quran, which is the word of Allah, and the Sunnah, which are the sayings of Muhammad, they interpret what they mean. Think about how they could mess with politics. Plus, these are the people who issued the fatwas. So if you don't keep the ulamas happy, what would stop them from issuing a fatwa against the Sultan? And if these three groups weren't enough, you still had to deal with the viziers. The prime minister, the chancellor, whatever you want to call him. Since the vizier position was created way back in time, during the reign of Orhan, the viziers were entrusted of running the day-to-day affairs of state, while the sultans had been the war leaders. The viziers were always in the capital. The sultans typically were away. This means you have to have absolute trust in the person running your empire. Well, as Mehmed got older, he would begin practicing what was commonly referred to as the Sultan's Retreat. When he no longer could lead his forces on the battlefield, he retreated to the palaces of Constantinople. Even worse than being away on the battlefield, he just stopped paying attention to what was happening. He trusted the viziers to run the show in his name. Well, this meant that if you really want to put pen to paper, this meant that the viziers were the people who actually ran the empire. So what happened if the vizier thought that the sultan was a loser?
He literally could rally the population against the ruler of the empire and take control for himself.
I mean, isn't that what Jafar did to Jasmine's dad? The goofy little sultan. In his big white floppy hat. Jafar came out with that badass snake scepter and brainwashed him.
And then if that wasn't bad enough, you had all the government officials, which we call the bureaucracy. Every government system has government officers. They work in all of the different governmental departments.
They were the bookkeepers. They were the advisors. They were the officials. Their primary job was, of course, to collect taxes. Because the empire needs taxes to sustain itself. But remember what the government agents used to do in China as the dynastic circle began to turn?
Well, if you couldn't trust the government officials, what would stop them from sticking their hand in the coins and kind of skimming off the top and making the monies disappear?
With no money, you can't pay your soldiers, which could lead to a rebellion by the Janissaries. With no money, you can't maintain infrastructure, which could cause the Sipahi to rebel. The flaws are limitless.
And then, because you have an empire, you have to put rulers in charge of all the provinces.
We'll call them governors to make it easy. Well, some of them were Sipahi, which meant they were probably only interested in their own territory. Some of them were war leaders, generals. But some of them were just outright politicians.
Well, their job was to basically rule the empire on the periphery for the benefit of Constantinople. What happens if they suddenly decided not to listen or to cause problems? By the way, I got a good example of what happens when there's a bad provincial leader in the Ottoman Empire, because we're going to see how England basically took Egypt.
So any of these guys could be problematic for the Sultan.
The worst part was, as I said, beginning with Mahmud, when he got old, every single sultan after him retreated more and more into seclusion.
The first sultans were men of the people. They walked freely in the villages, in the towns. They walked amongst the soldiers and the commoners alike.
But after Mahmud, the sultans became creatures of the palaces. They kept the public away. They made for themselves magnificent homes. They began wearing all the finest clothes, eating the finest food, worrying about their harems. Not trying to be offensive to our one representative of the fairer sex, but if a guy has 500 women at his beck and call, how much politicking do you think he's going to be worried about?
And as if all of that was not enough, I've already talked about this one as well. There was no rules of succession.
This meant every time a sultan died, any of his sons, any son, even the son from the lowest of the concubines, had the same right to claim the throne as the direct son of the empress.
So, what does this mean? Every death could result in civil war.
So what then happening started happening? Brothers began plotting against each other.
There were constant assassinations that took place. Brother would wipe out a brother.
As a result, the most scheming, conniving of the sons was usually the one who took the throne. Doesn't mean they were the most capable. Doesn't mean they were the most gifted, the best warriors.
And even if the brothers were not all killed off before a new sultan came on the throne, typically within the first few months, the Janissaries would go out and arrest any other potential claimant to the throne, oftentimes making them disappear in the desert. few did manage to flee. And every now and then, if you, I don't know if you ever read anything, but you see stories about, you know, some random, you know, Ottoman prince that just happens to be like in England. So, you have this great empire, and you have all of these problems. And ultimately, that's the reason why by 1683, they were spent. Because the problems were eroding the empire from within. Questions? And we'll see what happens when we come back to the Ottoman Empire for exam 3. Now, I'll give you a little bit about it. Because as far as empires goes, it's pretty interesting. Yes, it was a Muslim empire. Yes. Yeah. Remember how I told you, actually, you weren't here in the beginning. We don't have cumulative exams. I divide each exam up into chunks of information. So this is going to be on exam 2. When we come back to the Ottoman Empire, that will be on exam 3. No. You're going to have the second exam. So by the way, did everyone take it? I forgot. Someone in here had to take the makeup? Did you take it?
Yeah.
All right, good. All right. So I will go home and I will release the grades tonight. All right. So diverse. Well, all you got to do is look at the map that I had on before. It stretched across North Africa, all through the Middle East, into Europe, into Asia. And in all of those lands were different people. There were Christians, there were Jews, there was other religions, there were different sects of Muslims. It was diverse. And Constantinople would be the heart. So all of the different unique elements of this culture pumped inward and could be experienced in the heart of the empire. Now, granted, the city suffered tremendous devastation at the hands of the conqueror, but once it became his capital, beginning with Mehmed, all of the good, powerful sultans that followed built and beautified and expanded the city. That's one of the reasons why today, even though it's not called Constantinople anymore, it's called Istanbul. It's not just on the tiny golden horde, it is expanded on all sides of all the waterways. It's one of the largest cities on earth. It's on my bucket list. Because there are temples and mosques and marketplaces and just fabulous architecture that represents all of the different elements of this vast domain. One of the gems is the Hagia Sophia. The Hagia Sophia was built by the Byzantine Emperor Justinian in 537 AD. It was, for well over 1,000 years, one of the largest cathedrals on earth. And its construction is amazing. This massive concrete dome, which provides all of this open space, basically stays in place, doesn't squish the building, through exterior construction. It's counterbalanced by the footprint. So the structure of the Hagia Sophia pushes inward. Oh, go back. Pushes inward while the dome pushes downward, preventing it from falling. And again, how big is it inside? See, these are peoples. Right down there, those little dots, those are peoples. And there's the dome. 537. Those dead white dudes knew how to build stuff. Well, when Mehmed took the city, even though it was a Christian church, he didn't order its destruction. No, 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 no. He ordered it to be converted into a mosque. And for a few hundred years, the Muslim population were able to go. They were summoned to mosque, and they would attend ceremonies there. Now, FYI, I think it was about 20 years ago, it basically was decertified. The Turkish government basically declared it not to be a mosque anymore, and it became one of the world's protected sites, essentially like a museum. But about 5 years ago, the current president of Turkey, I think his name's Erdogan, who was trying to shore up Islamic support in the face of like America and the Russians. So he ordered it once again to be converted to a mosque. So this means, I don't think, for example, women can go into it anymore. I don't think you can go sightseeing. It's basically closed unless you're a resident of the city. Could be wrong on that, though. Well, as I said, every single sultan did something to beautify the city. Mansions, they had hotels. Constantinople was one of the first cities on earth that had hospitals. They had public and private gardens. They had baths. They had museums. Basically, everything within the city was beautified. And today, it is still one of the cleanest cities on earth. You're not allowed to chew gum in the city. If you chew gum, you will be arrested and imprisoned. Because what do people do with gum? Exactly. Now, this is an example of one of the projects that followed. This is the Suleimani Mosque. This was built by Suleiman the Magnificent. As the city grew in population, he ordered the construction of a mosque aimed at rivaling the Hagia Sophia. It is as grand and it has similar design. It's almost a carbon copy, but it's just not as big. But again, it just goes to show you how powerful and how wealthy the sultans had become. And they had marketplaces, commonly known as bazaars. They were filled with merchants and travelers from all corners of the empire and beyond. We talked about the Asian trade network. The goods from as far away as Japan and China would make its way into these marketplaces. You could get ivory from Africa. You could buy slaves. You could get wood products from Russia. Carpets from Persia, coffee, tobacco, you name it. Everything was for sale. By the way, the tobacco that you could find there came from America. You could get sugar from Cuba. It would be huge. And one of the most popular destinations inside the bazaars are the coffee houses. Because technically Muslims are not supposed to drink alcohol. That's kind of like a no-no under Sharia law. So they drink caffeine instead. But just like our bars, you know, that's where the men folk would go and they would gossip and talk politics and do like man stuff. And it ran smoothly. Because the Ottoman Empire would be one of the first imperial systems where they would implement regulations over the economy. You couldn't just do business if you wanted to do business. Like today, you'd have to get a license from the government. And your business would be inspected. one of the most common tools of the government agents, scales. Because if you sold things by the pound, what does your scale weigh the pound to be? So if your scale was tampered with and you were screwing over your customers, you'd get your license revoked. You would not be allowed to do business again anywhere in the empire. They were also some of the first people to inspect food production locations. Like today we have health inspections from the restaurant. The government wanted to make sure if you went and bought food, it didn't kill you. They also had rules on apprenticeships. If you wanted to be a craftsman, you had to get licensed and serve as an apprentice to a master. There's nowhere else anything like that on Earth.
It was completely unique. And I would like to give you the last one.
I don't have time to do it. Because we also got to talk about what happened to the religious minorities. We're going to give that a little time. There's only 3 minutes left. So I'm going to call it a class. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. I think it's not going to be snowier. I think it's actually going to get a little warmer. So hopefully some of the ice on campus will melt. So that way when we walk around, none of us break our ankles. See you all on Tuesday.